I'd like to welcome all of you to the National Summit to Save Our Elections. And before I talk anything about the coalition that put this together, I want to go back a little bit in time. In November, in the first week of November, there were a number of concerned citizens who were crying and then sort of getting together in small groups and trying to figure out what we could do, because there was this unsettling feeling that something was very, very wrong. And Congresswoman Hooley and Congressman Blumenauer gave us our first focus in January. They invited us through their office to attend a forum on election integrity. So they're sort of our sponsors in the government right now, and we were just thrilled to hear that the legislative session let out last night so they could come and be with us. Blumenauer will be with us tomorrow, but it is my great pleasure to introduce you to Congresswoman Darlene Hooley. Just a few words about her. She was sworn in January 4th, 2005. A sad day for some of us, but for her, it was a historic fifth term in office in Washington. That's just incredible. The patience and persistence to stick it out in that arena is just amazing to me. She represents the 5th Congressional District, which is all of Marion County, Polk, Tillamook, and Lincoln, as well as parts of Clackamas, Benton, and Multnomah. So she is many of your representatives, representative of many of you. She serves on the Financial Services Committee, the Veterans Affairs Committee, and the Science Committee, so very busy. And obviously she has election reform at heart. And with that, I'd like to welcome Congresswoman Hooley.
Thank you, Nancy. First of all, how many of you are here from some other state other than Oregon? Raise your hand. Wow. I want to guarantee you our state is not usually this rainy this time of the year and not this kind of traffic problem this time of the year. But we welcome you to the state of Oregon. We are thrilled you're here. And I know that a lot of you are visiting from other states, and that's what not only the work that the people have done in Oregon, but that all of you are doing across this country. You are so important to our democracy and taking back our democracy. So I'm delighted to talk to you about the integrity of our election system. I'd like to thank the Voters Rights Coalition and Alliance for Democracy, Portland chapter, for organizing this conference, and I know how much work it takes to make this kind of an event happen. I think Oregon is very appropriate to have this kind of an event. We are the pioneer of the country's first vote-by-mail system. I was there in the legislature. Yes. You will learn more about it. It is a very good system. I was in the legislature in 1981 when I voted to authorize vote-by-mail to be used in local elections. In 1987, it took us a few years, and a lot of people were very nervous about vote-by-mail. It was very controversial. But by 1987, all local elections were being done by vote-by-mail. And then in 1998, the voters liked the system so much that an initiative was put on the ballot to use it for all elections, and it passed by 2-1 margin. Over the years, concerns have arisen over the issue of ballot integrity, which were recently addressed by the Reed College study for the Carter-Baker Commission. The results of that study were very positive and pointed to a few key elements that helps Oregon keep the system secure. First is the signature verification process. And if you haven't seen this process, it is really amazing. Workers compare the signature on every single envelope. Every single envelope to their signature on their voter registration card. In this election of 2004, November election, just a little over 1,000 ballots were not counted because the signatures could not be verified. And we had record turnout for this election. Previous voters were required to sign a poll book. When we went to the polls, you signed a poll book. But those signatures weren't checked until after the election, which made it impossible to link the signature with the person and the person with a particular ballot. The other thing we found in this state is the partnership with the post office. And it's really important they understand, the post office understands all the rules that you play by. We work with them, we educate them. For example, you never forward a ballot to a different address. And while I'm here, while you're here, I encourage you to learn more about vote by mail, and I'm sure you're going to have some sessions on that. But it works. As a country, we've undergone a great deal of revision and improvement since the 2000 presidential election. Now, some of you may say, I haven't seen much improvement, but we have. In that, 1.5 million presidential votes were lost or disqualified due to antiquated equipment. But as in any major system change, we're bound to experience unexpected challenges, such as it was illustrated when many Americans voted electronically for the first time in 2004. It is fundamental, and all of you know this, to our democracy is the right to vote. And the integrity of our electoral system is paramount in protecting that right. That's why I joined my colleagues in supporting a General Accounting Office investigation of the 2004 to review that. Now, the unfortunate thing is they're only looking at a broad look at the election system. They're not looking at very specific allegations. They're looking at things such as provisional voting and the security of the voting systems. I serve on Financial Services Committee, and we're going to be doing this data securities bill in this next week or two. We have had a lot of our personal financial information stolen because people hack into computers. And it is the thing that I think all of us fear, how easy it is to get into systems and how important it is to have some kind of a paper trail when you're voting. I am pleased with many of the recommendations that came out of the Carter-Baker Commission that was released a few weeks ago. The goal of their recommendations are to make participation easier for Americans while enhancing ballot integrity, including a voter-verified paper record, which I strongly support. I think it's probably one of the most important things we can do. Out of all of their recommendations, probably the most controversial is the one that says all voters must have a voter ID card. And I think you have to look at that. I think it has a significant impact on participation levels, particularly for our elderly, low-income, some minority students. But I think this is something we need to look at very carefully. Other recommendations, such as setting uniform standards for counting provisional ballots, I think are definitely needed. In the 2004 election, Alaska counted 97% of their provisional ballots. Delaware, on the other hand, only counted 6%. So we need some uniformity there. That's a huge disparity when you think about it. I like to remind people the devil is always in the details, and it is, as these proposals move forward, it's important we monitor them. But one of the things I would hope you would do in this conference is really set some priorities. When you've got a set of recommendations from the Carter-Baker Commission, you have examples of what's happening around the country. But what is it that is, what are the one or two or three things that are the most important things? And we have a responsibility to ensure that every eligible voter has a chance to vote. And everyone wants to know that their vote counts. There has to be integrity to the system. That's a principle that binds us all together. That's what affirms our equity and our equality. I mean, voting is the one thing you do, no matter how rich, how poor, how powerful, how helpless. Every vote counts, and every vote should count. And what I'm so pleased about is that you have taken on this job and this role. First, by educating yourself, and second, by taking action. First, you have to know what you're talking about, then you have to take action with it. And I am worried about our election process under the current leadership. I don't know that we're going to restore the integrity of the system unless it is done by the citizens and by people like you. So I hope you would take back what you learned this weekend back to your communities, that you talk to your fellow citizens in your communities and engage them and talk to them about how important it is, because it is, you are the people that are going to make the difference. I hate to put that burden on you, but you're the people that are going to make the difference, and it's how we will all win. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your attendance and your willingness to take this issue on. It is, our democracy depends on it. So thank you for your time, your energy, your willingness to educate yourself, and willingness to call yourself to action. Thank you and good luck.
Darlene Hooley, 5th District of Oregon.
You heard her. It's up to us. Speaking of us, I can't help but be reminded of a phrase or a quote that's been used over and over again, but it just so fits our group. Margaret Mead's quote, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. And indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." That has come up over and over in my mind. There are 13 of us in the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition, and what we have done in 6 months has just been amazing. And if we can continue that, I know that we can change the world, because we're all connected to all of you, and those, all of you are connected to other people. We're talking to John Gideon today. He has, 150 people on his email list, the daily voting report. And he's convinced that thousands and thousands of people see that every day because of that sense of community. And what one person or a small group of people can do is pretty amazing. So just a few more words about our coalition. I'm actually with the Alliance for Democracy, and I met up with several other people from all different walks of life in November, and we got together and said, we've got to do something. And for the first month or so, we were trying to solve the entire country's election problems, but that became overwhelming, and we suddenly realized that it's a state's issue anyway, not a national issue, at least at the present time. And so we focused in on Oregon. So we thought we were focusing in locally, but as several of us were talking at dinner, the word local has changed so much. What is local now is so different than 10 years ago. If we were going to do a local teach-in 10 years ago, we would probably draw folks from maybe 100 miles away, maybe Seattle, maybe Eugene, but truly local geographically. But suddenly local for us meant Massachusetts, Madison, Wisconsin, Arcata, California. It was just incredible. the network that we consider local. Even though most of you, it looks like, are from out of state, there's just this sense of this is our community, and that's really quite nice. In our search for what to do, we decided instead of to prescribe to our government officials what had to be done, that we would go into learning mode first, because we found out that we really didn't understand our system, even in Oregon, where we vote. And so we spent quite a bit of time with our Secretary of State's office, the State Elections Director office, and a number of the county clerk's offices. And in fact, much to their chagrin, probably three of us spent 3 days sitting listening to the county clerk's annual or biannual meeting. We just wanted to be citizens listening to what they talked about. And we were there to educate ourselves for the most part. Then we decided we wanted to share our learnings, and the conference came about. And as I said, it quickly turned into a national thing rather than a local thing. We also decided very early on that we would be democratic about our process. And our own little experiment with democracy was very interesting. It's hard work. It is really hard work. From choosing the color of the logo to choosing the meal tonight. And by the way, thank you, Kathy Jackson, for a lovely meal. Democracy is very hard work. It's not a slam dunk whatsoever. And our group of very like-minded people discovered that. But here we are. We built it, and you guys came, and we are just thrilled. Very quickly, I want to mention who is all in the coalition. I said that I myself is with the Alliance for Democracy, and so is Joan Horton, who was the tabling coordinator and also the budgeting person for this process. Beth Hahn, most of the presenters are here tonight because of Beth's networking and her encouraging you to come. Thank you, Beth. The third person is Betsy Salter, a name that you mostly know, but she's not here. She was unable to attend due to a previous, a very important family thing. But she brought to us this tremendous level of professionalism that just kind of blew us away. We became, instead of this little homegrown Portland group, we actually sounded like we knew what we were doing once Betsy rewrote the words for us, so that was great. And I know most of you have had contact with her through email. And then, of course, Jan White. She was our database manager, both for the volunteers and the presenters and the participants, and many of you had contact with her for the homestay coordination. Then there was Beth Peterson. Oh, my gosh. Is Beth awake? Is she here? Maybe not. There she is. Beth did all of our graphics and all of the printed materials, and that agenda changed, 957 times? And she pulled an all-nighter last night, so I'm glad she's upright and able to join us today. Yes. Then there's Jerry Adams, who is on the Oregon Mandatory Audits team. By the way, Jan White is too, and you'll be hearing more about that tomorrow. But Jerry was sort of our father confessor and our resident psychologist. Deb Whitcomb, our registration coordinator. Let's see, Kathy Jackson, I mentioned, food organizer and purse holder, the money coordinator. Casey Hansen, our physical logistics coordinator. She also did a lot of the speaking to the media, and we got some nice coverage, along with Binks Tenenbaum, who did our press coverage, too. So thanks to both of them. And Ginny Ross. Oh, my gosh. Ginny Ross did all of our IT work, our website, and the physical logistics. She was here early this morning, along with Casey. and just did amazing work. And then myself, I'm Nancy Metella. I'm going to tell you 2 sentences about me, because I have asked all of the 13 people to participate through the weekend in emceeing. I'm not going to emcee anything else, because I wanted you to meet the whole team, because the whole team put this on. And I also asked each one of them to give you a couple sentences on who they are. We are not activists. Excuse me, we are not professional activists. We all are from different walks of life and are just ordinary concerned citizens. I am sort of a Jill of all trades. I have a master's in business. I'm a small business consultant. I'm also a real estate broker. I'm a mother, and as I said, I'm a concerned citizen, so not unlike the rest of you. I'm going to end, I know, Mark, I'm a little over, aren't I, by reading something from Ode magazine. This, if you don't know this magazine, it is incredible. It is out of the Netherlands. It has a world view. It's quite interesting. And their byline is, "The magazine to change our world," with the parentheses, "your world." Nice little articles. It's very short. It's called "The 4% Solution." How many cars would you have to take away from California's crowded roads to rid them of gridlock? A computer simulation supplied the answer. Only 4%, or 4 cars out of 100. The study provided inspiration for actor Tom Hanks in a remarkable speech at Vassar's College graduation ceremony this May. If this simulation is correct, it is the most dramatic definition in earthly science and human nature of how a simple choice will make a jaw-dropping difference in our world. He calls it the power of four. Take the power of four, 4%, and apply it to any and every area of your concern. Politics. 4 votes swung from 100 into another 100 is the difference between gaining control and losing clout. And boy, did we experience that. 2 ticket buyers out of 50 can make a small, odd film profitable. In economics, by boycotting a product, 1 consumer out of 25 can move that product to the back of the shelf and eventually off it altogether. 4 out of 100 is minuscule and yet can be the great lever of the tipping point. I've always thought tipping point was 10%, but this study says it's only 4%. The power of 4 is the difference between helplessness and help. To me, that says people right here in this room can make a huge difference in election integrity. So with that, I'd like to introduce our first speaker this evening. Actually, I think he's the moderator. And that is Brad Friedman, whose mercurial career has just been amazing this last year to me, and actually in the last couple of months, and even the last couple of days. There's 2 things, Craigslist and Bradblog, right? Everybody knows Craigslist and Bradblog. Brad also has a progressive talk show as of, what, 3 months ago? Something like that. It's just amazing how it's caught on. And his influence is just spreading. And Beth told me that you've had a number of interviews in the last couple of days and have one with Ann Coulter tomorrow. That's pretty amazing. I exchanged emails with Brad just real quickly about a concept. We progressives need to call into conservative talk shows and have dialogue with them. And I don't mean necessarily antagonistic dialogue. I mean just ask them questions. Questions. And Brad is very good at that. So with that, I'll invite Brad to come up, and he'll introduce the panel.
Thank you. I'm Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. I'm just going to say a word or two very, very quickly because I want to get on to our panel and hopefully leave enough time that we can hear from some of you folks with some questions for these guys. They're really good. I do want to thank, however, the organizers of this conference. As Nancy mentioned, the Oregon Voters Rights Coalition and the Alliance for Democracy Portland. And I want to point out that those are very, very fancy names. And it sounds like there's just a huge group of people who manage these amazing events. And I can tell you, these organizations are not huge groups of people. They're individuals like Nancy and Beth and Betsy and those folks, and the tireless work of those people makes a huge difference. So when you see these fancy names like the Alliance for Democracy and the Oregon Voters' Rights Coalition, don't make any assumptions that they've got everything taken care of and they don't need your help. They do. On the other hand, at bradblog.com, we are a major news organization. Come visit us in our newsroom sometime soon. Okay, speaking of which, I want to also, to that same regard, thank all of you guys for showing up, each and every one of you, because each and every one of you makes a difference. Thank you all for giving a damn. So it's people like you. Yeah. People like you who show up at these sorts of events that, you know, let's face it, they can be kind of dry and dull. And I'm going to do my best to keep this one from becoming too dry and too dull because it's just too damn important. So just thank you all again. Election 2004 and the issue of election reform was recently called by Project Censored the number three most underreported story of 2004. The fact that what's going on with our democracy needs to make a list like Project Censored, and the fact that we have the type of elections that we have now in this country, and they're getting worse, not better, despite all the work of you folks out there. They are getting worse, not better. The bad guys are way ahead of the curve. They are. The good news is we're catching up. We're catching up, but it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of you guys taking what you hear here this weekend and getting that word out to the folks who couldn't make it here, or the folks who wouldn't make it here, or the folks who don't give a damn. Bother the crap out of them when you get home and let them know what you heard here. I can talk a little bit more about that later because I'm going to have a discussion with one of those folks who bothered the crap out of some people, Robert Kohler of Tribune Media Services. He's out here somewhere. There he is. He and I are going to talk and compare our enormous newsrooms in the second part of tonight's event, so stick around for that. Now, I'm fairly new to the pitfalls of electronic elections myself. Something happened, though, on November 3rd, of 2004 that suddenly made me notice something was amiss. I have studiously paid attention for some reason since then, and the folks who are going to be on our panel tonight have helped me understand this situation and what's going on. First up will be Paul Leto, who is currently suing the Sequoia Voting Machine Company. Nice. Yeah. Nice going, Paul. Get those bastards. He's also been very instrumental in a lot of the work that I've been trying to do in the organization that I helped co-found, VelvetRevolution.us. So, Paul, thank you, sir, for your help there. Ellen Tyson of VotersUnite.org is going to be speaking. I should mention what they're going to be. Paul is actually going to be speaking about the problems with computerized voting. Problems with computerized? Holy cow. All right, well, we're going to get right to him then. The problems with computerized voting, the lack of transparency, and the privatization of elections and software, and its effect on democracy. Ellen Tyson, then, from VotersUnite.org, is going to speak about the Help America Vote Act of 2002, which took care of all the election problems we have in the United States. And she'll tell us how. Also, the involvement of vendors in the election system, privatized vendors who have some money that they can spend on that, unlike groups like us. Diebold. So she's going to talk about that. And then a fellow by the name, some of you folks may or may not have heard of him, we'll find out later. A guy by the name of Clint Curtis is going to be here to tell. Nice going, Clint. You don't even have to show up. He's going to talk, for those who don't know his story, he was asked to create a vote rigging software prototype in Florida by a very good friend of the Bushes. Fellow by the name of Tom Feeney, who's also a big fan of mine, I hear. No, really. He reads the Brad blog every day. Let's see. Well, I have a story that I wanted to tell, but I want to get right to these guys. I can beat up on the New York Times later when I sit down with Bob Kohler, and we'll talk about what he does over Tribune Media Services and how I ended up doing what I do over bradblog.com, and hope to get your questions and all of this stuff. These guys are the pros. I just report what they have to say. Because, frankly, someone has got to. So apparently that's fallen to folks like me and you. Thank you for doing that. Speaking of which, by the way, tonight's program may well make it onto tomorrow night's Brad Show, which we're going to be broadcasting from here, I think, down in the basement or something. It's all right. If it's good enough for John Conyers, it's good enough for the Brad Show. Down in the basement we go. All right, so you've been forewarned. Anything you can, you say here, can and just may be used against you on tomorrow night's Brad Show. So be very careful. All right, let me see. Paul Leto. Paul, you've already got. Paul Leto is an Everett, Washington business law and consumer fraud attorney, a retired governor of the Washington State Bar Association, and was voted Rising Star in 2003 and 2004 by Washington State Law and Politics magazine. In January 2005, Leto and Dr. Jeffrey Hoffman were co-authors of a paper entitled Evidence of Election Irregularities in Snohomish County, Washington, General Election 2004. Good paper, bad title.
It's science.
It's long, yeah. That's Sequoia's claim of proprietary trade secrets and refusal to allow production of data and information regarding the 2004 election thwarted further scientific investigation, which then led to a lawsuit by Leto and co-plaintiff John Wells seeking to void the purchase contract for the Sequoia electronic voting machines on numerous public policy and state constitutional ground. Yes, go get him, Paul. He presently serves by appointment of the Washington State Supreme Court to the board in Washington State that has regulatory authority over continuing legal education requirements for Washington State attorneys. Ladies and gentlemen, Paul Leto.
Okay, a shorter title, Leto v. Sequoia.
There you go. Yeah.
Okay. I'll try to be concise. I have limited time. Judge Damon Keith in 2002 said and wrote in an opinion, democracies die behind closed doors. I think democracy never dies directly. In other words, nobody's going to make a direct attack upon democracy. What happens is that democracy is either redefined or it's called something else and even made fun of. So how would democracy die in the United States? Well, it would be called inefficiency, for example. It's inefficient to have all these different checks and balances. It's redundant, you see. So if you called it checks and balances, people would say, wait a second, no, that's something I learned about and I believe in. But if you call it just inefficiency, or if you call it a lack of speed in reporting election results, call it something else, you have a much better chance of being able to kill democracy, whether that's what you intended to do or not, that's what you end up doing. So I was asked to talk just a bit about basic concepts, because otherwise, you know, I might get into the long titles and all that other stuff. So that's democracy. That's a little bit about democracy. Democracy is rule by the public, by the people, as opposed to some sort of oligarchy. It's kind of, instead of the pyramid with the ruler at top, it's the inverted pyramid. Maybe we can do something with the pink triangle people and work it out and get both symbols going together. Because really the people are supposed to be on top in a democracy. They're the source of all legitimate political power. Yeah. So Thomas Jefferson, in writing the Declaration of Independence, and it went through several drafts, and sometimes it's interesting to see what was in the first draft versus what was in the later draft. In one of the first draft, Jefferson actually referred to slavery as a, not an abomination, but in very strongly negative terms, and that got taken out in further editing and discussion with others. But anyway, Jefferson was clear that there are some things you just can't do. They're unalienable. You can never do it. No matter what you do, it's not going to work. Okay? What are those things? You can't take away the people's rights. They're unalienable. You cannot destroy the legislative power. Jefferson referred to an attempt to, quote, annihilate the legislative power, but being ineffective. I mean, the king can disband the legislature. It doesn't matter. Why? Because all legitimate political power comes from the people. To a certain large extent, we've forgotten who's in charge in a democracy. And we have a rule by experts and rule by our elected representatives, because we do have, you know, a somewhat Republican and with a small R form of government. Now, because we've forgotten that, I mean, Naomi Klein, I don't know if you folks have seen some of her stuff or read her books, but they're very, very good. She made an interesting observation that this whole fad with makeover shows and makeover books is really, the overlying idea to it is give up yourself to experts. You know, the experts are going to come in and make everything just amazing, like the experts in FEMA. Now, the people are in charge, and yet the people have, in today's age, very, very little power. And that power has been completely eliminated, essentially, by the rise of electronic voting. So I did say this here in Portland, in this very venue a couple months ago, but I want to emphasize, so people keep clear in mind what an election is precisely. It's the transfer of power from the people to the government. It's the only, there's only that one little channel there, that one little link or nexus between the people and the representatives and the government. And that's where the power and the tax money has to be approved and transferred. Now, the government has a conflict of interest in administering elections because it gets its money, it gets its tax money, its power, and so forth from those very elections. So while we can have government workers watch elections or help out with something, they cannot provide the policing function. There's another non-delegable duty. The people cannot give up or waive or quit their duty to police elections. Because if you want to have a democracy, meaning the people are in charge, meaning the people have to watch that one thing, because that little channel of power is the only thing that makes it a democracy. You cut that channel, you cut the ability to monitor the integrity of elections, and then you certainly no longer have democracy. And that's what we have today in all of the jurisdictions that count votes electronically, in my opinion, because the electronic software is claimed as a trade secret, which is it's a property right. And that trade secret software is not disclosed even to election officials, like Secretary of State Kevin Shelley. He asked Diebold for some disclosure, and they said, Mr. Secretary, we can't give that to you. Well, if that's an accurate quote, we can't, that's a lie. They could at least have them sign a confidentiality agreement, and they could keep their trade secrets and stuff. But the point is that even the Secretary of State of the largest state in the United States is not allowed to know exactly how the votes are being processed in the software or to otherwise investigate that under a claim of trade secret, which is a piece of property. So what that means is that you really, as a private citizen, although you might in a recount situation be able to look at a few ballots or participate a little bit in that, you're never going to, in a public records request, for example, get all of the ballots that you and your friends want to do a recount. You know, the election's over. There's not any more official counts. You just want to check. You will never get those ballots, okay? You will never, they'll fight you, you know, to the highest court in the land. You'll never get from the corporations how it is that they process or what methods of analysis they use in that software. So under conditions in which the data of a process like elections is not disclosed and the methods of analysis or the counting methods are secret and not disclosed, we're merely provided, we being the public, the people who are supposedly in charge, we're provided with results, conclusions, that's it. You get nothing underneath that. Or what little tidbits of information you get is nothing sufficient on a scientific or investigatory basis to figure anything out about it. So, in terms of basic concepts, trade secrecy and elections and democracy, you can make this statement, which is 100% accurate and defensible, and it's not spin, it's not an exaggeration. Whenever there's electronic vote counting, there's no basis for confidence in the results of those elections. That doesn't mean necessarily that anything went wrong. It's just that you have no right, if you believe in rationality, you have no right to believe in those elections. You know, you can't even go into a court on a speeding ticket. The government can't. If you subpoena the radar technician in most states and say, I want to know how that thing works. I want to know if you calibrated that thing. I want to know how you calibrated and what that software says. Even on something as simple as a speeding ticket, they're going to have to disclose that pursuant to your subpoena. Why? Because due process requires it. You cannot be fined $200 for speeding consistent with due process if you think there's an issue as to the accuracy of that machine. Well, we think there is an issue as to the accuracy of these machines for voting, but they're not going to give you anything. You have to be able to recognize that the emperor has no clothes. And regardless of whether there are actual, you know, evidence or proof sufficient to convince you that particular shenanigans went on, there's still no basis for confidence in the results, and that has to change. It has to change because the people are supposed to be in charge. The people have to reassert their right, their unwaivable right, to police elections, observe elections, and verify to make sure that they're accurate. What if, let's just say that a dictator shows up and takes over the presidency of the United States. And decides that, you know what, it's really inefficient to have Congress, they're always quibbling, you know, all these decisions. Too many cooks spoil the broth. Use your common sense, people. Come on, look at all these guys, they just vote themselves pay raises all the time. And these activist judges, get rid of them. We can have the trains running on time, okay? Think about it. But let's just say he hasn't even, you know, the president hasn't even begun to articulate all of the persuasive arguments for dictatorship. Let's just say that the dictator has, you know, taken over and the Congress and the courts have been shut down. Should we, under this hypothetical, take a wait-and-see attitude? Maybe he's going to do good stuff for the country, eh? Well, I co-wrote a scientific paper on irregularities, and, you know, I've talked about that before, and there's amazing stuff. But I want to pose a deeper question. Because the mere fact of signing a contract to bring in electronic voting machines eliminates the checks and balances of elections, eliminates the public's ability to see what's going on, eliminates any rational basis, eliminates all rational basis for confidence in the election results, that's a form of coup in terms of election integrity. So the question is, what evidence do we really need? What more do we need? Just like with the dictator taking over, you're going to take a wait-and-see attitude? The checks and balances of elections are critical to preserving democracy. And that's why we ought to be very serious and very clear about our political theory of democracy, because as soon as you remember and read the Declaration of Independence and remember what democracy is all about, then the proper relationships between the parties become very clear. And then when the election officials say, you know, you guys are just like untrusting, you know, we don't like this audits and supervision stuff, who's in charge here? Oftentimes you'll find out that really some of the counter-arguments that people are making against audits and stuff like that are really either anti-democratic or at least certainly inconsistent with the public and the people being in charge. So the burden of proof, use kind of a legal term, is not on the public to prove that X election was stolen, although people want to do that, that's great, you know, but we don't need to prove anything. See, we're also in the position of being the, because somebody else has created the veil of conspiracy and, you know, the veil of secrecy, I should say, by making the data and the methods of analysis secret, then those who think about, gee, you know, why would they go to such lengths to make that secret are then labeled the conspiracy nuts. So this is the game that gets played. A, create the veil of secrecy. B, denounce the people, the citizens who are concerned about that secrecy, because they necessarily have to speculate a bit and quite often are wrong. You know, so we got to watch out for that. But the burden of proof is really on the professionals who are supposed to be working with the elections. They should prove that they've done their job. They've performed an election with integrity, and that the election results are accurate. How? By showing their data and by showing their methods, just like grade schoolers have to show their work in mathematics. It's 1 + 1 = 2. What's the problem? Well, my time is up, but the problem is that if you look through history, there's always been a debate in every year of our history between people that really don't think we can trust the public with power and people that truly believe in democracy. And that debate goes on throughout our entire history, and it goes on today. But I think we should be on the side of democracy, because worldwide, that's the winning side. Worldwide, that is the one thing that nobody will dare to attack directly, because it's the truth. It gives equal dignity through one person, one vote, to all of us. It is the way in which we come together as a community to govern. Thank you.
Just to break things up, I want to ask real quickly, Paul, before we bring up Ellen. You say there's no basis for confidence for the results in electronic elections. Why haven't there been, you're suing Sequoia, why haven't there been more lawsuits? What happened to all those attorneys that were supposed to be out there on election day? Why are you the only guy suing?
Well, I guess I was one of the army of 12,000, or 17,000 it ended up being. But the idea wasn't to be ready to sue at all, although the media tried to say Kerry has 17,000 lawyers and the implication is that they're all ready to sue. It was just to make sure that people's voting rights were protected, and you know, I can't ask somebody, are you Democrat or Republican, so you just help everybody vote. But what I noticed being in the polls, and I was, you know, I was placed in a Democratic area and noticed the machines voted all Republican, that's what got me interested in doing the study. So, but the first part of your question.
Why aren't there more lawsuits, more attorneys? I know that there's maybe not a lot of money suing counties to void their contracts with voting machine companies. Maybe there is. I don't know. But you're in Snohomish County suing Sequoia.
Right, and the county.
Where are the other? I know Cliff Arnbeck is very busy in Ohio, but there's not a lot of folks. Seems like we should have a lawsuit in every damn county and every damn state in America.
Well, we probably will before long, but you know, there's a lawsuit in Tennessee. There's one in Maryland. I think California. There's one probably that's not filed yet in Georgia, maybe coming up. So there's more activity out there, perhaps than even we know about. But, you know, one of the reasons is that, you know, litigation is very, very expensive and time-consuming. And, you know, for some reason, when I sued to void the contract, I said, I want $6 million, but not for me. I want it to go back to the county. And the county is still upset with me for some reason.
I don't know why. Well, you're a hero for doing it and for fighting the good fight you're fighting. So thank you, Paul, for doing that. All right. Ellen, hang on to your questions. I promise at the end, as long as I don't natter on too much, we'll have some questions from everybody for the entire panel. So let me get to the next person here. Ellen Tyson is the founder and executive director of VotersUnite.org. In her 22-year career as a software technical writer and illustrator, she has created hundreds of user manuals, functional and design specifications, online help systems, and programmer guides. And so she knows about this computer crap. She created and maintains the Voters Unite website, along with John Gideon, who's right over there. Thank you, brother, for all you do. These guys do amazing work. Please support them any way that you can. Early in 2004, Tyson wrote Mythbreakers for election officials to dispel. Yeah. To dispel myths about the Help America Vote Act and inform decision makers of important underpublicized facts about electronic voting issues. That's for election workers, right? Boards of elections and so forth?
Right.
Yeah?
Right. It was intended for county election officials, state election officials.
You're saying they're underinformed?
Decision makers. What?
Are they underinformed for some reason?
Oh, yes, they are underinformed.
Wow. I had no idea. I thought they went to elections integrity school and then came out knowing all they needed to. Maybe I'm wrong. In support of paper ballots, she is now working with a group that is developing a non-computerized method of providing independent voting to the disabled, and she's doing much, much more. Ladies and gentlemen, Ellen Tyson.
Let's see how this goes. Much of the reason that we are gathered here today is because of a law that Congress passed in October of 2002, the Help America Vote Act. And I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, are somewhat familiar with it. And the reason I say that is a lot of the reason that we're here is because if that set off a kind of a feeding frenzy among vendors, the voting machine vendors, the ones who are selling electronic voting machines. And that's why we saw this huge increase in electronic voting, which caught so many of our attention and really got this movement going, because it became bad and we realized it was a problem. If you are going to be involved in this and be an activist, it's important for you to understand a few things about, just some basic things about HAVA, because there is a huge amount of misinformation out there still, even though we have made a huge effort and to clear a lot of it up. Many people have been working on that, but there's still a lot of misinformation. One very significant thing, which maybe you all know, HAVA does not require that you get rid of punch card systems. Now, that's something that you read in probably at least one newspaper article every day, is that HAVA requires states to get rid of their punch card systems. Not true. HAVA provides funding to help pay for jurisdictions that decide to get rid of their punch card systems. But the voting machine vendors have, and who knows how many other people have been, in order to sell electronic machines to the counties, they tell them that they need to get rid of their punch card systems. So we see secretaries of state who believe this, election officials, directors who believe it. We see it printed in the newspaper. Not true. Another misconception is that you have to use electronics to run your election. That's not true. HAVA doesn't require electronics. It specifically preserves the right of jurisdictions to use hand-counted paper ballot systems. It does not require electronics. But again, you can see, if you're trying to sell electronic machines, it'd be a real good thing to have out there that you got to use electronics. You know, you got to get into the 21st century. Another misconception is that HAVA is going to pay for all of this new equipment. HAVA pays for some of this new equipment. And HAVA does not pay for the storage, the maintenance, the repairs from 5 years from now. It's not going to pay to when you have to replace these things in 5 or 10 years. It's just going to pay for some of the acquisition costs. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Right. Well, yeah, that's true. Of course, the taxpayers are paying it through the federal government, and the taxpayers are paying it through the state government, and the taxpayers are paying it through the local government as well. That's true. Another very common misconception is that... I need to back up. As probably a lot of you realize, HAVA does have certain requirements that all voting systems that are used in federal elections must meet. One of those is that every polling place must provide a voting method, by which people with disabilities are able to vote independently. So this has been... I have read more news articles that say HAVA requires that there be one DRE, one direct record electronic, one paperless voting machine in every polling place. I read that all the time. HAVA doesn't require that. It requires a voting method that allows people to vote independently. Now, the really ironic thing is that the paperless voting machines, many of them don't provide the kind of accessibility required by HAVA. But it seems to be generally out there in the atmosphere that that if you need to provide accessibility, do it with the DRE. Well, Brad mentioned something that a group of people and I have been working on, believing that you could provide that kind of accessibility for disabled people without electronics. Took it as a challenge, and we have developed something that we there is a woman in Massachusetts, Helene Thayer, who has been testing this, and I'll just show you briefly, and you're welcome to look at it. It's very similar to a ballot developed in Rhode Island, which they use to provide accessibility for blind voters. We have a cover, and then inside there's a ballot sleeve that's a transparent sleeve, and you can see the ballot through it, and then there are holes at the locations where you mark. So it prevents stray marks on your ballot. These little dots that you see here are bumps, and an audio tape accompanying this tells blind voters what bump represents what candidate, so they can mark the ballot. Now that's the part, the little bump dots, that's the part that has been used in Rhode Island before. And then this looks really simple here, but we've experimented with a number of things. This is to help people who have limited use of their hands turn the page easily. People who can't just grab a piece of paper, but would be able to fit a hand in here if they had a permanent fist or a prosthesis to turn these pages, so that then they can get to the other side and vote. You could have as many pages in it as you need. And then this right here is a sliding a shield, so that if the person can't carry it to the polls, they can have a poll worker come get it, and you pull the... First you got to release the ballot from the ballot sleeve. You pull this sliding sleeve out, and you can deposit it in the ballot box or in an optical scanner. And so this is something we've been working on, and I don't know if this is going to satisfy HAVA. I don't know if any county is going to use it, but I would like to encourage people to start thinking about this. You know, what other ways can we provide this kind of accessibility other than with computers? Okay, moving on. The other thing that I wanted to talk about is what kind of an impact the increased use of computers is having on our elections from the perspective of the fact that election officials are not usually expert computer users. Legislators, judges, election officials, secretaries of state are not computer experts, and yet they are the ones who are making the decisions about this equipment. And the county election officials are the ones who are running the equipment. The more computers are used in elections by officials who don't know how to use computers, the more we have technical support coming from the voting machine manufacturers. I read an article about Elko County, Nevada. This was in after the 2004 election, that the woman, the election director, had mentioned that they had some problem and a few votes were lost and then they were found. You always get an incomplete story in the newspaper. It's very frustrating. So I called over there and she was very willing to talk to me. And what had happened was the DRE, the voting machine, I was going to say paperless, except that they did have, you know, the paper, toilet paper roll papers. They had left it in test mode accidentally. And so when they went to retrieve the votes from it, they couldn't retrieve the votes from it. And they didn't know what to do. And she said it was frustrating to me because we didn't even get one day of training on how to use these machines. Not one day. So they'd had problems with it before the election when they were trying to print out their zero tapes and stuff. But they weren't sure exactly what to do with it, what the problems were, so they didn't pay a lot of attention. Anyway, they did get it solved. The Sequoia technician took the cartridge to his office and was able to retrieve the data from it. Problem solved. And she didn't seem to see that that was a problem. Okay, so we've got voting machine vendors installing the software, repairing the software, getting the data off of the cartridges when the election officials can't get the data off of the cartridges. Driving up here, John Gideon and I were looking over an open records request that he had submitted to the state of Washington. Ran across some really interesting things. One of them was an email that had been sent to the Secretary of State's office by Sequoia. It was before the certification examination was going to take place. And she had said, I don't remember the names, Joe and John and I will be coming, and Joe will be doing the test on the Insight, and Jim will be running the certification test on the DRE, and I will be creating the test ballots. So now we've got the Sequoia technicians representatives who are running the state certification testing in addition to everything else they're doing. And then the other interesting thing that we saw was that there was a screenshot of a version number of the election management system. The screenshot said 3.4.2. I might be making that number up, but the point remains. Not that point. The 3.4.2. Okay. And the email exchange between the Secretary of State and Sequoia was, we understood that the system that was being certified was 3.4.2.1. Well, it turns out that it is 3.4.2.1. It's just that for those of you who know about computers, you just get ready to shiver here. The module that displays the version number was not changed in the system. And so it was displaying the wrong, obviously it was displaying the right version number for itself. Anyway, that's, for those of you who don't, that's pretty silly. You don't just have an entire module that displays your version number. So, basically what it is we've got a system that when you ask it what version it is, it displays the wrong number, which means that version control is out the door and you just trust the vendors to install the right version number, make their repairs. Another interesting thing in South Carolina, they got ES&S paperless DREs so close to the 2004 election that they didn't have time to train the election officials in many of the counties. So they announced that ES&S would be running the election and the election officials would be observing. And now we're finding out that the same thing has happened with Diebold running the elections in Georgia. So what we have here is a situation where the people who are in charge of doing the process, the election officials, don't know how to run their equipment. And so they have to get the voting machine vendors and technicians and representatives in to run the elections for them. So, a couple more things. What can we do about it? I believe in information. I believe in the spread of information. Let people know. Become informed and let people know. And realize that audits are not audits of our elections. Significant audits, counting the paper ballots by hand to check the machines, are not a luxury, they're a necessity.
Good ending. I like that. The trim. I'm going to do it too, yeah, when I'm done here. Thank you, Alan, very much. Let me get to our next speaker here. The whistleblower in America is... unfortunately, we need more and more of them, and we're beginning to hear from more and more of them in many places, thank God. I've recently reported at Bradblog on a source who, for now, I'm cleverly referring to as Deep Throat. He is an insider at the at Diebold, and has been talking finally, and because in small part because of what this source is saying, Diebold fell, their stock prices fell 20% last week alone in the days after we reported that. There's been, many others that have been involved with election reform matters. Cheryl Eaton in Hocking County comes to mind as a great hero, indeed, as she reported on what was going on in Ohio after the election in that quote-unquote recount down in her county, where Triad, another fine American voting machine company, apparently created cheat sheets for all the counties so they wouldn't have to bother to actually count the entire county by hand. They could just use the cheat sheet, do their little 3% random selection of precincts, and they would not have to count the whole county afterwards. Cheryl Eaton is a hero. Another hero comes to us tonight. Clint, you ready? Yeah. Get on up here. Clint Curtis is a computer programmer who worked for Yang Enterprises, Inc. He doesn't anymore. Yeah. They're down in Oviedo, Florida, and he worked there until 2001. His allegations revolve around his employer, Yang, and a highly connected Republican congressman by the name of Tom Feeney. Curtis gave sworn testimony to the U.S. House Judiciary Committee minority members when they were doing their investigation of Ohio. He gave a sworn affidavit to me about these facts. He has a remarkable story, even though he was a lifelong Republican. And, of course, when I ask him what he is now, he says, yeah, I'm conservative Democrat. Nonetheless, Clint Curtis, unlike Paul and Ellen and myself, are not. He is not a highly paid activist and professional, as the three of us are. Man, this activism business, we make out like bandits. Clint Curtis, so I'm going to let him say a few words about his story, and then I'll try to grill him with a few more questions and get out the full story, and then we'll turn to your questions. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Clint Curtis.
Hi. Well, he pretty much told a story. I don't know if everyone knows who Tom Feeney is, though, because I think he left that out. Tom Feeney, at the time, was the Speaker of the House of Florida. He was the head lobbyist for Yang Enterprises, their corporate attorney, the running mate of Jeb Bush, and the elector assigned to George in his first and second term. He was also the fellow, I don't know if you followed the 2000 election, who put forward the idea that since the legislature can assign any group of electors they want regardless of the vote in Florida, he was going to give the vote to George whether he won or not. And that's what he said. So this is Tom Feeney. And in 2000, he came to the company and he wanted a vote-flipping program. And so I thought he, because he's a Republican, makes him a good guy, right? So, at the time, and so I built one, and then the owner of the company tells me that I don't understand, it's not to prevent fraud, it's to in order to flip the vote in South Florida, because they need to control the vote there. So, you know, after I determined all the illegal activities that was going on, there was also espionage, there was also overbilling. You know, first I reported it to the IG's office, the Attorney General. Then I reported to the FBI and the CIA and all these people, and they all ignored me. So finally I reported to the real power, the Brad blog. And that's when all this has started. So that's basically it.
All right. Have a seat. Let me grill you a little bit here, since I'm the real power. Clint Curtis. All right. You. Hello. Jack. It's me. All right. Thank you. All right. So, Clint Curtis, let me get this story straight. Actually, let me ask. How many folks here are not familiar with Clint Curtis's story at all? Okay. Cool. You should read the Brad blog. All right. So to make that clear, Tom Feeney, who was the Speaker of the House of Florida, at the same time he was doing that, he was also the general counsel and registered lobbyist for a software firm by the name of Yang Enterprises, Inc., correct?
Correct.
Okay, no conflict of interest there, right? All right. Did they have state contracts, Yang?
Yes.
Okay, no conflict of interest.
It's Florida.
Please use your microphone. Oh, what's that?
It's Florida.
Yeah. Well, Florida needs to thank Ohio, because Ohio has, I think, displaced them for the dirtiest state in the union, if you want my opinion. All right. So you were asked to create this vote rigging software, and you contend, you say, that you thought it was to keep the Democrats from doing this.
Correct.
All right. And the next day you turned in this software to Mrs. Yang, the president of the company, correct?
Yes.
And she then, what happened to that software, Clint?
Well, I gave it to her and told her, here's the software, and I'd also written up, you know, the procedures you would go through to make sure that you verified the vote and that you couldn't cheat.
Right.
And that's when she told me, you know, that it's not in order to get the contract, we need to hide the vote in the software because it's for manipulating the vote in South Florida. And then she took the disk and she took the paper and she said she'd give it to Feeney and off she went.
All right. Now, you said when Feeney came in, he asked you for three specific things that the software needed, that he wanted you to write, three specific things.
Right.
And you swore to this in your affidavit.
Correct.
We've got police waiting outside, sir.
Again?
Yeah. And so what were those three things?
It had to be able to be run on a touchscreen machine. It had to be able to be activated right at the console, not sitting across the street or anything like that. And he wanted it so that the manipulation would be hidden in the source code.
Meaning the source code, so that if someone looks at the source code before it's compiled, and I'm going to try to keep this from getting too tech geeky, but these programs, they're compiled, but first they're written by human beings, like Clint Curtis, and that software can be, that source code can be reviewed to make sure everything is on the up and up, or kosher, as they might say in Florida. So
Miami.
You wouldn't know. Right. It's a Jewish thing. Anyway, so if somebody looked at the software, they shouldn't, the source code, they shouldn't see these boat flipping routines.
Well, that's what he wanted, but that's not actually possible.
It's not possible.
Right.
Okay, and you told them this.
Told them that, put it in the report, and that's why I thought there would be nothing to it, because what kind of an idiot would allow you to put a program out there to count the boat without being able to verify it?
Well, you suspected then that counties would actually look at the software. They wouldn't use secret proprietary software. They would look at the source code to make sure it was all on the up and up before they used it.
I would assume they would have asked a computer person before they passed laws to say, you're allowed to do this.
And yet, the software that's used in our voting machines is proprietary, and nobody looks at the source code prior to its use in the elections.
Correct. And they, even if they provided them with something they said was the source code, they don't validate it, they don't compile it, they don't put it on the machines.
Which is remarkable to me. I don't understand how we can be voting on the secret software that you've talked so much about, Paul Leto, that nobody actually validates this stuff, that nobody certifies this stuff. Had they made that a law, then the sort of program that Clint Curtis claims to have written would be no good. Am I correct in that, Paul Leto?
Yeah, I think there's just a lot of, people get phased or overly impressed or overly trustful of techno-wizardry. So they just assume that everything is going, in spite of all the evidence, that, technology is going to work.
That nothing, what could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, I mean, the space shuttle's been doing fine, and
yeah. You have a cold, dark humor, Paul Leto. Okay, well, I want to report to those folks who aren't familiar with the story that I have been trying to look into Clint Curtis's story, and I'm trying to catch him in a lie however I can, and so far I have been unable to. On the other hand, Tom Feeney, who now sits on the U.S. House Judiciary Committee, yes, he does, has been caught in one, frankly, lie after another, as has the Yang Enterprises, Inc., one lie after another. And there's so many details on this story, some unbelievable things, some Chinese spies that Clint Curtis reported about in 2001, and in fact, in 2004, Hai Lin Henry Nee, who was working at Yang Enterprises, Inc., working on this company that creates software for NASA, Florida Department of Transportation, speaking of NASA, he claims in his affidavit that this fellow Henry Nee was inserting wiretapping modules into software that was going to FDOT, Florida Department of Transportation, and NASA, and then in 2000, and you reported that back in 2001, and then in 2004, the fellow you reported as being an illegal alien, in fact, turns out he is an illegal alien, and we found out that because he was arrested on 3 counts of espionage attempting to send anti-tank Hellfire missile chips to China.
Correct. Yet Yang Enterprises still maintains the highest level of security clearance.
And Tom Feeney, who ran unopposed in 2004, has a campaign office. Where is that located?
That's in the Yang building.
Cool.
Well, he's not shy about it.
No, he's not. One other part of this remarkable story, and then I want to get to questions from you guys about Clint's story and all of these others, because we have just about 10 minutes left here before we take a break and come back with Bob Kohler. You reported the story back in 2001 to the Inspector General, as you said, of the state of Florida, a fellow by the name of Raymond Lemmy.
Yes, Raymond Lemmy.
After you eventually left Yang and moved on to the Florida Department of Transportation, where you worked and reported, I guess, some things you found there to Lemmy, who was the Inspector General for Florida at the Department of Transportation. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. He was looking into your story, and a few years later, in June, let me get it right, mid-June 2003, after you had left the Florida Department of Transportation, you ran into Ray Lemmy. Tell us what happened in June of 2003.
Well, after I left, Ray was kind of investigating on his own, so he would come in and grill me with all kinds of questions because, you know, I don't produce a lot of information unless you ask me. So, kind of quiet that way. That's why you're good. And so, you know, this went on for months. And finally, in the mid-June, he came in and said he'd tracked the corruption all the way to the top. He was ready to blow the story open. And just wait a couple weeks, and I'd be thrilled with the results. And then June 1st, they found him dead in a motel room in Georgia. So,
the police ruled the case a suicide. Mm-hmm. When I asked you about it the first time, I said, well, what the hell was Ray Lemmy, who worked out of Tallahassee, Florida, what was he doing in Valdosta, Georgia, which is just over the border a bit, one of the major towns across
the border. It's about 100 miles away from Tallahassee.
Miles. I asked you why was he in Georgia, not in Florida, which apparently nobody seems to understand. I haven't been able to find out. You had some speculation.
Well, in Georgia, you're not required to have an autopsy if you have a suicide. In Florida, any suicide is required to have an autopsy. So when he committed suicide in Georgia, he's exempt, cremate the body, he's done.
And now, I hate to be a rumor monger, so, let me add that I have looked into this very thoroughly and, in fact, have read the police report that where the police in Valdosta, Georgia had determined that Ray Lemmy, that it was a suicide. And they took photographs of the crime scene. No, I'm sorry, of the scene. Did I say crime scene?
You said crime scene. I think suicide is a crime.
It was just a scene. Photographs of the scene. Unfortunately, due to a failure in the camera's flash memory, the photographs were not available. So we can't really look at them unless we go over to Brad Blog, where we found the photographs of the Ray Lemmy suicide. And the Valdosta police have confirmed, in fact, these are legitimate. And guess what? There are items in those photographs that don't match up with the police report. So I don't like to spread idle speculation, frankly. I really don't, because bloggers get in trouble for that sort of thing all the time. So I tried not to do it. But there are so many troubling points in this case that it needs to be pointed out. You guys need to know about it. You guys need to know that the photographs that don't exist do exist. You guys need to know that the information that he's talked about is all available in public records. You can look it up. You can find out. You can look through his story. And I ask you folks to do that, not just with this story, but with all of these stories that you hear. Make public records requests. Find out what the real story is. Get the information. You can get it. If it's trouble in Florida, they've got a very good sunshine law. All you got to do is call them and say, I am making a public records request for yada yada, they'll send it to you. You don't have to do any paperwork or anything. That's very important. And Clint Curtis's story is very important, I think, because it really underscores how easy it could be, to fix these machines. We don't know that his software was ever used in any vote rigging scheme, but the program that he put together, and I think you're going to talk more about it over the weekend in a workshop.
Yes, we have a workshop, and I'll actually show it, and you can see the code. And
24 lines of code, I think, you can flip the vote. And as long as this stuff is kept proprietary trade secret that nobody can look at, Diebold claims that they have to keep this stuff secret, I think, because competitive secret from their competition. They don't mention that they also make ATMs with open source software. So, I guess there's no competition in the ATM market, but apparently there is in the voting machine market. What's that?
They also have paper trails.
They have paper trails in the ATMs, don't they?
You wouldn't use them if they didn't, would you?
Okay, let's see. Do we have questions from folks? Because I can ask some questions, but you guys all probably do. And I have a cordless mic, so I can run around and play Phil Donahue now. Okay, we got 10 minutes, and then we're going to get out of here, take a break, come back with Bob Kohler, and I'm going to do Phil Donahue. Here we go. I'm running around. Yes, sir, your question.
Walking forward. That's a federal law. And yet, a number of people, probably thousands of people that were on the scrub list of 44,000, fit that category, yet our president won by the fellow that was elected won by 534 votes. There were thousands of people that would have voted against him. I don't understand why nothing was done about the 2000 election. Thank you.
Thank you. Any of you guys want to speak to that really quick? I can announce that Jimmy Carter, by the way, just admitted the other day that, and let me get the quote right, that there is no doubt in my mind that Al Gore won, that Al Gore beat George W. Bush in 2000. 5 years late, but anyway, there you go. He admitted it. Yeah, Paul, you wanted to speak to that?
Regarding the felons, you know, each state has different rules. I don't know what Oregon's are. Washington, you have to finish your conditions of sentence. So that means, A, you need to get out of prison, and B, you need to pay off your restitution. But last night in Seattle, we heard from some folks that have spent a few years in prison, and they've informed us that, for example, on those restitutionary obligations, they may be set at $20,000 or something, but it starts earning 12% interest the day of the conviction. So by the time you get out, it's a very large sum of money, and so they see it as a poll tax. You know, so that you'll basically never get out from under if you don't have a lot of money. But there are lots and lots of issues with you know, the issues of felons voting or not voting.
I think in Florida, though, they didn't even finish the recount. The Supreme Court just said, you win, and it was done. It was no longer a question of counting anything or protesting anything. Right, but when the U.S. Supreme Court said George won, I think everything else was pretty much done, especially since Gore had already kind of backed out and left the country.
Three quick one-sentence questions. Should we have a national standard for how ballots are created and counted? Two, what is your view of this Carter-Baker proposal? And three, should we have a national election law establishing independent control and oversight at the state level?
Ellen, you want to speak to that?
I'm afraid I didn't understand.
Oh, that's okay.
You sounded kind of fuzzy.
All right. You wanted to know her opinion on Baker-Carter? You called it Carter-Baker. I'm going to call it Baker-Carter. Should we have a nationalistic that? Should we have a national standard for how ballots are created and counted? Ellen Tyson.
Okay, the two questions. I'm not very excited about the Baker-Carter Commission report myself. If you go to I can't remember the website, CarterBakerDissent.com.
Yep.
And read about the process. It wasn't at all a democratic process, according to these people. It was, you know, people who were dissenting were not listened to. So how do you come up with any kind of a fair report that way? In addition to some of the content, which I think is really not good. The voter ID and what they do for audits is ridiculous. It's like, you know, maybe you ought to do audits, kind of an attitude.
And that website, CarterBakerDissent.com, was set up by Spencer Overton, who
right.
was one of the commissioners on this panel. They just came out with their results last week. And it's a disaster. And actually, I'm going to talk about it tomorrow. Beth? Tomorrow? Yeah? Yes? Tomorrow.
Good.
And I'm going to be brilliant and talk about it. Yeah. 2:30? Oh, it's going to be great. And so we'll talk about that for sure.
Good.
That panel is a hoax, though. Let's, for electronic issues, who's got... Let me do this. Hang on. Sharona, speak up.
Stand up?
Yes, stand up.
Well, this isn't a question exactly, but I wanted to point out a correlation that I detected. I've been writing about the correlations between the promised technology and the e-voting industry, and that Robert Gates, who is a former CIA director and connected with the NSA and CIA, was one of the chief purveyors of the promised technology, knowingly with back doors by which to spy on client countries. And he is now presiding over Vote Here and SAIC election engineering. I just wanted to point out that there was a similar murder to Ray Lemmy's murder, among many murders in the promise history. And that murder was Danny Casolaro. He was the author of the book, The Octopus, which I've been writing about, which is about secret government. It's called The Octopus, Secret Government and the Death of Danny Casolaro. We started looking into this in 1990 or so, and was found murdered in the South in 91 in a bathtub filled with blood with his arms slashed. I wanted to bring that to your attention because I know Ray Lemmy's murder was very similar, and I think there may be a pattern. And also, the murders that followed after that along the lines of the promised technology research involved Jim Keith, who was one of two authors who took up the mantle for Danny Casolaro after he was murdered. His wife, the mother of his two daughters, and also the publisher, were all murdered. Yeah.
I'm told that we have to get out so we can take a break and come back for the second half of the program. Thanks, Sharona. Clint, do you have anything you want to say on that?
I'm hiding.
You're hiding? you should. All right. Any closing comments you guys want to make very quickly before we get out and take a break? Paul, yeah.
encryption makes everything secret, okay? Second, national standards, bad idea, one virus, all 50 states. And also, conflicts of interest. Only winners of elections make election law. So, you know, that's a problem, unless you do it by initiative. And then Carter Baker is,
Yeah, it's junk. Ellen, any closing thoughts before we take a break?
No.
Okay, I want to thank everybody. I'm sorry that we didn't get time for enough questions, but we're going to come back. We're going to take a five-minute break.
Hold on.
And Robert Kohler and I are going to come back. You want to say a few words?
Yes, I'm Ginny Ross. I'm here to introduce the five-minute break.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Before you do, I want to thank Clint Curtis, Paul Leto, and Ellen Tyson. Thank you guys very much.
Okay, everyone, before you go, this might be met with mixed enthusiasm, I realize, but in my other job, I'm a fitness instructor, and we have a saying in the biz, don't make me come out there, okay? 5 minutes, ready, go. That's it.
Oh, yeah. Appreciate your inspiration.
Without going into great detail, we just listened to a panel, What's Wrong with Electronic Elections and What Can We Do About It. Brad Friedman was the moderator, and of course Brad's going to be on the regular Brad Show tomorrow night from 7 to 11 Eastern, 4 to 8 here in Portland. You're listening to the National Summit to Save Our Elections from the sanctuary here at the First Unitarian Church in Portland, Oregon. And tonight we have one more panel. Meet the Press, the media stumbling block, bypassing a complacent media to sound the alarm on elections in crisis. That's what's happening tonight. I'm here with Hoki Anderson of Sunday Monitor at KPFT in Houston. I'm Otis McClay. And got any comments for this five-minute break? Don't make her come and get us.
Well, no, we don't want to do that. That was a pretty heavy-duty panel, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I'm sorry there wasn't more time. I'm also, you know, when we start talking about the murders, it kind of gets interesting. When you think back to the Kennedy assassination, and I think it's up to like 82 murders. 82 people died who were, you know, witnesses or had an interest in it.
Oh, just of that, of the JFK assassination?
Well, I'm just saying that it seems to happen when there are these national events of some significance.
Mm-hmm.
So she was talking about a few there.
Yeah, it gets very unseemly when you start overturning some of these rocks. You find some very nasty things. There have been several deaths, 3, 4, 5, I'm losing count now, of people, not including Ray Lemmy, who have direct involvement in the elections industry or investigating it. So, yeah.
I don't know what to say to that. I mean, this is, again, it's just sort of the WCTU needs to get involved here.
Have you told the listeners about your plan? I don't know if that's a good plan.
No, I mean, I don't know that it's not a good plan, but, you know, I don't know if you could talk about it.
Yeah.
But there was a reference to Kerry Nation and, you know, Wichita, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the methods that the WCTU used to change the liquor laws. Historians probably would, you know, people who have an interest in Wichita and bloody Kansas would probably understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly seems as though paper ballots is a very safe way to go if you're interested in having honest, fair elections with records which can be checked, and if you can, you know, then recheck, make sure that you've got it right the first time, or even the second.
Well, you know, it's pretty darn simple when you get right down to it. A friend in Maine told me how they do it. I've seen some of the descriptions in Canada. It's so simple in Canada that it's almost impossible to find a description of it anywhere on their website.
You mean a paper ballot with an X?
The actual process of counting the paper ballots. They just get a bunch of people and count them for some hours. You know, in Maine, they have divide it up into stacks, and then one person counts, and then somebody from a different party counts, and they don't tell each other what their answer was, and then they compare at the end and see if it's right, and if it's right, okay, you know, other people do other piles, and you know, you count it in the precinct in front of everybody, and you do it until everybody agrees. And how simple is that? Instead of, you know, once the chain of custody is such an important concept in balloting, especially if you have an actual ballot rather than these electrons, because if you can guard that chain of custody, preferably from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. or something like that, and guard it afterwards under video cameras during the counting, then all you need is that number. You don't have to guard anything anymore. You got a number, who got what. Everybody signs it in duplicate and triplicate, and you go from there. But this business of having a chain of custody all the way from the software development through trucking, through warehousing, through elections that last for 2 weeks, through absentee ballots, In Houston, I know that in other places, too, sometimes the election officials are told to bring the computers home with them to guard them. Also, now you have all these other locations, like somebody's car trunk or their garage, or they stopped at the donut shop. I mean, it's like a sieve, this chain of custody. It's not even a chain. It's a bunch of dots.
The assumption is when you fix something or change something that you're getting something for it. And the question is, what do you get when you go to computers? I mean, how expensive are ballots?
Well, I think the American public has bought this notion that paper ballots are retrograde.
Old-fashioned.
It's something for their old-fashioned, and we need something shiny and flashy and silver-colored.
Better.
And that there's something broken about paper ballots, and gee gosh, everybody knows you can steal paper ballots. Well, yeah, sure, maybe, but many of those paper ballot systems were created by the same people who are corrupt, who are now creating electronic systems. The point is to you don't really trust unless you verify, any more than you would walk into your bank, drop a bag of money, and say, don't worry about counting it in front of me, just count it later, and don't even bother to send me a receipt. You know? I mean, that's where we are. We are like, here's a bunch of votes, don't tell me how you're going to count it, who's going to count it, who you're going to count it in front of, and don't bother to give me a piece of paper. You know, that's too much trust. We're not even just talking about our bank accounts here. We're talking about our democracy. We're talking about the opportunity to have decent governance that might actually respond when people are up on roofs and don't have any way to get away.
No helicopters in that family.
Right. Right. So this is, well,
yeah.
I'm not exactly objective about this, having thought about it for 2.5 years. It's as important as anything. You just can't get more important than how are we going to govern each other using representative government, and is somebody actually going to be elected that we chose?
Somebody going to be elected that we chose. What a
concept.
A concept. The idea that government... Oh, here's Brad. Brad saw a microphone. He needs to come over. No. You can speak. The concept that a government would actually want to serve the public instead of, you know, serve it to its little friends.
Yeah.
What we're doing is we are... Pokey Anderson and I'm Otis McLean. We're here in Portland, Oregon, at the First Unitarian Church, at the National Summit to Save Our Elections, and we're just about to hear the... It's already been more than 5 minutes. She's going to have to go get them.
She's going to have to go get them. Brad, you want to say a word?
Yeah, say a word, Brad.
I'd love to. No, you stay there, because I'd love to say a word, but I'm being told by the organizers that I have to go up and start the next portion of the program.
Yeah, you do, because we want to go home tonight.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll hurry.
All right. So she's calling people back, right. And I wouldn't fool with her.
Tick-tock.
We're going to do this is Meet the Press, the media stumbling block, bypassing a complacent media to sound the alarm on elections in crisis. A lot
Yay,
of words
back.
To say what's going on. It's going
to
be Brad Friedman
warm up the mic
and
here.
Bob Kohler. Bob Kohler is a columnist for the Tribune Syndicate, the Chicago Tribune, and he has a story to tell.
Kind of fun. I had the job of working on the website, and as such, I had to get all the pictures for all of our speakers. So I had to do a Google search for Brad, and I came up with, on the images, Brad Friedman, leather. So I clicked on it. I thought I had hacked into the GQ magazine server. No, really. It was tough to choose.
So it wasn't a Jeff Gannon thing that you discovered about?
No.
Okay, good.
No.
Keep looking.
It was a very fetching leather jacket, okay, in case I didn't give enough information, okay. Maybe that was too much. But in any case, those 5 minutes I promised you, they're gone. Anyone else coming in that door? Push-ups. Okay, no, you can come in.
Get closer. Don't be scared.
Thank you for coming to our summit, and welcome to the Rose City. This is our first day of rain in 05. It's true. Just when the tourists come, that's when we... Now, my name is Ginny Ross. I'm with Democracy for Oregon, and our Democracy for Oregon coalition, springing out of the Howard Dean campaign, is part of the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition. My other job is I'm a lawyer, and I work in the area of the estate tax, so I might soon be out of a job. But I'll always have activism, as was reminded us by Dr. Bob Fertekas. Working for social justice, it'll never pay well, but the work is steady. So, I'll keep working. As I said, I was activated by the Dean campaign. It was huge here in Oregon. And so the election that I'm not over is Iowa, January 2004. That was my introduction to the legendary circle shoot that we hear about now. So I'm one of those newly activated, still going, what the? And then I've got 2000 to deal with, but luckily, since Carter came out and solved that for us, we've got that solved, and so now we can move on to 2004 and try to figure out who won that. Gee, I wonder. Tonight, I have the honor of introducing to you Bob Kohler. And Bob is an award-winning journalist. I'm very glad that he's here tonight. He is an editor, teacher, poet, and fiction writer. Bob is a nationally syndicated columnist with Tribune Media Services out of Chicago, and readers have called him blatantly relevant. A hero of democracy. They've threatened his life and wished him an inoperable brain tumor. So, he must be on to something. Bob's articles tell the truth, and they are outside the beltway. That's why they're so important to us. He writes articles that are a wedge of outrage into the mainstream media. We need more journalists like Bob, and especially for his recent article, The Silent Scream of Numbers. The 2004 election was stolen. Will somebody tell the media? Alert the media. Okay. It's even more important. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm honored to introduce to you a proud and vocal member of the reality-based community, Bob Kohler.
Well, hi, I'm really delighted to be here, and I feel real weird being on this side of the podium. I am much more comfortable being over there. I feel like I'm in a room full of heroes, and everybody I talk to, I've been in Portland about 4 or 5 hours now, and I've had quite a few conversations, and every one of them has blown my mind. I believe everybody in this room has a piece of the puzzle, a piece of the picture that I don't have, and I'm here to learn. I feel, I don't know what I've got to say, I'm really here to learn. Maybe Brad will help me understand what I've got to say. The kind of energy I have is the kind that will take 10 hours to produce 800 words. It's a little different to just kind of talk off the cuff about the media, which is what we're going to do tonight, and I don't know how it's going to go. Later, I guess I'll be talking on Sunday morning as well, and the idea of that talk is going to be what I learned at the conference. What about this conference might make it into my next column, and. So that's really what interests me, is what I can suck out of this conference to continue my education in what's happening with our democracy. And it scares me deeply. And I just want to continue to play a role in sounding the alarm that something is wrong. I'm also sitting at the table with somebody that is really a big hero of mine. And when people ask, you know, well, what can I do, or how do you be the media, I have never met anyone in my life that has figured out better than Brad Friedman how to be the media. And I have a lot that I want to learn from him. I have been in the media for 30 years, but I want to learn from Brad, because this is, I mean, he's done an end run around the bullshit that I live in, and there's a lot that I can learn from him. So I'm okay. That's all I've got to say for now.
Earlier, I think it was Nancy who had introduced me and said something about a mercurial career,
right,
that I've had. No, it's a mercurial duty. I had a career before. I used to make money.
Right, right. I know what you're saying. Yes.
Now it's a duty, and that's why I do it, and yeah, that's why I think all of these folks are probably here.
Right.
You've got a pretty incredible story to tell. I know some of it you're comfortable talking about, some of it you're not. Let's make it very clear before we start talking about some of this.
Yeah.
That you work for Tribune Media Services.
That's right.
They're separate from Chicago Tribune.
Well, it's part of the Greater Tribune Corporation, which also owns a lot of other papers, like the Los Angeles Times, the Baltimore Sun, Newsday, the Orlando Sentinel. So it's part of a media empire, one of several, and I am part of that, and it's the syndicate part of the Tribune. And it's called Tribune Media Services. It's not the Chicago Tribune, the newspaper.
So if I beat the crap out of Chicago Tribune, that's not who you work for directly.
Correct.
Correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
But why would you want to do that?
Well, I would never want to beat the crap out of the Fourth Estate. They're doing such a great job.
Right,
they're
exactly.
Due to Americans.
Exactly, exactly.
That's
why there's so many of them here in the audience.
Right. The media is, AP is here.
They're AP is here. All right.
Are you here?
All right.
Allison Presnell, that's her name. They call her AP. She's not really.
Actually, it's Amy Pincus.
You're right, it is Amy Pincus. All right. The media, you know, has not been here. They haven't been anywhere. They haven't been down in Nashville at the election conference that was held down there. Where's Bernie Ellis? Thank you very much for that amazing conference down in Nashville.
Bernie.
Because that's where I got to know Bob Kohler. There was a panel set up for media. I can't remember what the name of it was. This one, by the way, is called Meet the Press, but I think it should be called Beat the Press. I'm just saying. But I think that it was myself, Bob Petrakis, and Bob Kohler, and Bernie said, oh, we got a guy from Tribune Media Services. I said, you got an MSM guy? As we called him in the blogosphere, mainstream media guy. He must be the bravest man in the world to show up with me and Petrakis. I was all ready to beat him up. Turned out it was Bob Kohler, and he was one of the good guys. And your experience in Nashville, it seems, changed. You want to talk about that? Was when you came out and you wrote this first column called "The Silent Scream of Numbers." The 2004 election was stolen. Will someone please tell the media? Now I thought you were the media, but you can clarify that, and then we can get to some of the things that happened since that in Nashville.
Well, I actually wrote a column before this one that happened to run in the Nashville Tennessean, and Bernie saw it just as he was organizing the conference. and invited me to come. I had been on the fence on the issue of the... No, on the fence isn't the right word. I had been in deep despair and denial about the 2004 election, and actually in the 2000 election as well. And I felt as helpless as everyone else. And I kept waiting for the media to rescue us, even though I am the media, or I am in the media. And I felt hamstrung. I just didn't know what to do. I write a weekly syndicated column. It was overwhelming how much data was out there for me to start getting on top of to write about this. I got an email from a friend of mine, Harvey Wasserman, who probably a lot of you know, saying, "Bob, are you going to ever write about the election?" And that was enough to kind of tip me and to start looking, and I read the Conyers report, really was what got me going. And so I wrote that first column, and it just by wild chance ran in the Nashville, Tennessee, and they hadn't been my client up until that point. And then Bernie invited me, and I went, I was not saying the election was stolen, I was saying a lot of African Americans waited long lines in Ohio, and there was a lot of Jim Crow tactics, and it looked really crappy what happened. I didn't think that it had an effect on the result necessarily. After I was in Nashville, I had a rebirth of outrage when I saw how many really, really smart people, really smart computer experts, numbers crunchers, that heard the numbers screaming. And that was a little phrase that I wrote down in my notes, that the numbers are screaming to these guys. And it was then became the central metaphor for my column that I called The Silent Scream of Numbers. And by the time I left Nashville, I did believe that the election was stolen.
You're listening to veteran journalist Bob Kohler.
So that's basically the story.
And yeah, so you wrote the first column, The Silent Scream of Numbers, which is an amazing column, and it actually has a great close, and maybe we'll be able to close with it here tonight. But then you followed it up with another article, Democracy's Abu Ghraib, If They Can Disable an Election, What's Coming Next? And then you had, now let's make it clear, you're a Tribune Media Services columnist. So you write these columns, they go out to the media services,
right.
to the affiliate newspapers.
They go out to the clients that subscribe to the column.
Clients meaning?
Client newspapers.
The Chicago Tribune is one of them?
No, it's not one of them.
It's not one of them.
No, it's not one. No, even though I work in Tribune Tower, the Tribune itself is not a client of mine, but I, as a courtesy, I send them my column every week, and they use it every now and then they use the column.
Okay, and so various clients around the country, newspapers that can choose to run your articles or not.
Correct, yeah.
And how many folks ran the Silent Scream of Numbers? How many clients?
Well, I think I got mail from four papers, so that indicates there were four people ran it. There may have been more, but I don't always know who runs the column, and unless I do get email.
I see. And then so you wrote a second column, Democracy's Abu Ghraib, but in the meantime, after your initial article, what happened?
Well, what happened was that a lot of people thought that I was an actual Chicago Tribune columnist, and so there was kind of a funny, happy mistake was made, a fortuitous mistake. People started writing to the Tribune wanting to know why they weren't running my column. and there were hundreds of letters. It was pretty amazing. I mean, it was amazing for me to get that kind of response. And I was like, well, what is the Tribune going to think of this? Most of the editors don't even know who I am at the Tribune. There's a few that I that I'm in touch with for, you know, work-related reasons, but most of them don't. So they thought it was, I was a little bit dumbfounded that this was happening. And then I got a phone call one afternoon from the Tribune's public editor, Don Wycliffe, and he writes a weekly column related to reader issues. And so he was going to do a column on the phenomenon of all these people writing in, urging the Tribune to run my column. And we talked, and he wanted to know. Well, I don't remember exactly what he asked me. It was a friendly interview, and I was pretty excited. I thought that it was going to be at least a neutral column that that brought the issue out in the op-ed page of the Tribune. Talking about, you know, the pro, you know, both sides of the issue.
So let me clarify. He got so many letters that he wanted to write a column on the phenomenon of getting the letters asking them to run your column.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he didn't personally get them, but the Tribune got them, and he decided to take that on.
And before you tell us what happened, did they run your column, Bob?
No.
Did he tell you when you talked to him on the phone that he was going to run the column? I mean, did it come up? Did you say, hey,
well,
great, are you going to run the column?
At one point it came up, and he said, well, that's not, that's not my call. Which is probably true. He was acting on his own.
Because he's the public editor, the ombudsman of sorts.
Yeah, right.
To respond to the complaints the public has about the paper and so forth.
Right, yeah.
Okay. So, I interrupted you. Press on. He was going to run a column.
Yeah, right. So the column came out the next day, and it was pretty disappointing. It was sort of, the heart of it was that was the moral example of Richard Nixon conceding the 1960 election, and
he pointed out what a gentleman Nixon was.
Well, yeah, right. What a good. I mean, what a moral example he was for people now that are complaining about the 2004 election. And basically, he just sort of, what I called off-the-rack arguments, like, oh, you know, conspiracy theorists, and kind of a lame sports analogy. It was not a very well-thought-out column, and it was a little bit, it made me cringe. And he quoted one reporter at the Tribune that was embedded in Ohio, the way others are embedded in Iraq, apparently, who said that he talked to people that were nonpartisan and they found no irregularities in Ohio in 2004. And that was good enough for him. And I, in other words, it was just, it was a sad column. It was sad in that it didn't even come up to the standard of challenging the real arguments that people are making.
Let me quote here from you writing about that Wycliffe column. You said, of all my objections to what he wrote, his contention that Kerry has the most at stake in all of this is the most dispiriting, because apparently he said that because Kerry conceded, then he shouldn't care, and neither
right.
should we. And this most reflects the wrong-headed, quote, horse race coverage of elections the media have shoved down our throats for as long as I can remember. In his column, Wycliffe used a sports analogy, pointing out that it's not the pregame prognostication and experts' opinions that count, but the numbers on the scoreboard after the contest has actually been played. The Bush team won, the Kerry team lost, and the voters must be the equivalent of sports fans then, either jubilant or disappointed when the game is over, but couch potatoes either way, not participants.
Right. This is something. It was Paul, when you quoted Naomi Klein about the whole makeover phenomenon, turning your life over to experts, I mean, this is the media's crime, is that it is complicit in convincing us that our life has to be turned over to experts. This is my dedication, is to break the media of this. I mean, it's terrible. I mean, it's just it's a criminal abdication of its duty. To be a watchdog and to be the protectors of our democracy.
That column I was just reading from was called "Citizens in the Rain," an apt title for tonight. The subtitle: Maybe we can't have election reform without media reform. I agree, Bob Kohler. let me say that I wanted to point out this column in particular because you wrote this in reply to what Don Wycliffe wrote in the Chicago Tribune based on the column of yours that never ran in the Chicago Tribune.
Right.
So you wrote this column. This is a very rare piece of paper. This is the column that Bob Kohler wrote that the Tribune Media Services decided they couldn't run. It responded to Don Wycliffe, who was writing in the Chicago Tribune about the column that they didn't run in the Chicago Tribune. And so his response to that was not allowed to go out to your clients via the Tribune Media Services. Why? It didn't go out. Bob did a different wrote a different column.
Right. Well, it went out on my mailing list, and it went out on the internet, and it's all over the internet. It's
don't know how that happened, Bob.
No, I don't either. No. I don't know how that happened. It's so weird.
That's weird.
Well, this is a very tricky issue, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because it's sticky. The thought was that it was too specific to the Wycliffe column to have a national interest or a national significance. And that may or may not be the correct opinion, but that was the thinking. And it was made by people that are otherwise very, very, very supportive of me. So the issue was not the content of the column. I mean, the election-related content of the column, but the specifics of being an internal fight between two people in Tribune Corporation.
The way you explained it to me, that and I want to make it clear, because your immediate bosses or whatever, media supervisors, were very supportive of you, still are, and were supportive of this column, right? So the contention was that it was, and it wasn't necessarily made by them, but that this was too much inside baseball, sort of?
Yeah, inside baseball, maybe one way to say it, yeah.
Well, here's I mean, you know, since this didn't get out, there's a couple of just incredible passages that I really want to get out. My fantasy of this is from Citizens in the Rain. My fantasy of the mainstream media actually doing their job and living up to the words they carve in marble to describe their own importance is an 80-point Terry Schiavo or even Pope John Paul II-sized headline running across the top of tomorrow's paper: election results in doubt. That would stop a few hearts. But the nation's major newspapers, even as they struggle with their declining readership, have no intention of being quite that relevant to their readers. No intention. No, No intention, it appears, even to begin the process of looking into the hornet's nest of vote fraud allegations abuzz in meticulously researched reports on electronic voting or the voluminous Conyers report on what happened in Ohio on November 2nd. Isn't our democracy at stake? Doesn't that matter? You see, it goes on and on in this inside baseball way that they couldn't let... The last two paragraphs, the stakes are getting higher and higher. Could it be we can't have election reform without media reform? The, quote, respectable press. Who are they?
Yeah, I know. I was going to wear a tie tonight.
Yeah, the respectable press refuses to confer the least legitimacy on the citizens who are questioning this election and demanding accountability in the voting process. How do we make them care? How do we make them look for themselves? How do we make them stand outside with us in the rain waiting to cast our ballot for democracy? Great question. Boy, am I glad they didn't run that, Bob.
Yeah, I know.
That sucks. All right, so how do we make them care? You're inside, you're in there with the mainstream media, whether you like it or not. How the hell do we make them care?
I wish I had an easy and simple answer to that. When people started writing all these letters to the Tribune, I thought, this is how we do it. We just keep writing and writing and writing and writing. The upshot of the maybe 500 or 600 or 800 letters that came in just related to my own columns was that one letter ran in the Tribune, and it was my own letter. instead of running either the first column or the second column, they gave me about 400 words, and they ran it as a letter to the editor that was in the response to the Wycliffe column. And that's all that got in, other than, there was one other letter, but it was related to the 1960 election and Nixon and Kennedy.
He was a great moral example, Bob.
Yeah, I know.
I read it in the Chicago Tribune. It must be true.
Yeah, it must be true.
It's true.
Black and white.
Yeah.
I think that it does take what everybody in this room has to offer, multiplied by two or three or four. I was talking to Emily Levy today. Do you mind if I just quote what we were talking about a little bit? It was a really moving and extraordinary conversation about, is there risk involved in this kind of work, as, Sharona was bringing up and Clint, maybe there is, and she said something on the effect of, if something does happen to me, it should happen not because I'm in this 10%, because I'm in it 100%. I mean, if there is a risk, even being a little bit involved is going to be a risk. So why not just be way involved? I mean, 100% all your life. I mean, give your whole life to it. And I think that's the only way to make the media, to break the media. David Cobb was talking earlier today about the personhood of corporations. And the mainstream media, they're all corporations, and they commit the same sins as other corporations, and that's truly part of the problem. And I don't know how that gets dealt with. I mean it's a larger issue than just the media. I don't know what it takes. I don't know what it takes, except that it takes energy, effort, and everybody and people speaking out, and then when nobody listens, continuing to speak out. And I think eventually there will be changes.
Well, let me ask you this, Bob. A lot of people have asked and said, they've been writing letters to the editor. They've been sending email to their friends and to their fake conservative brothers-in-law,
right,
and so forth, trying to get the message out, and they're signing petitions and feel that doesn't have an effect. You're inside. You got those letters. Did you? How did your letters change after you wrote that article? Your email.
Hits
to your website.
Right. The hits to my website went up at least 100-fold. I mean, from not very many to thousands per day. I mean, 7,000-8,000 a day for a while. It was so it was pretty dramatic.
Go ahead.
It was a very dramatic change.
So when you get all of a sudden mountains of letters like that, when Don Wycliffe gets mountains of letters like that, when the Chicago Tribune, do they notice? Is it worthwhile for these people to, to send letters to the editor and to make that kind of noise?
Well, I think that's part of it. I mean, I think what you're doing is also part of it, too. I think that you should tell a little bit about how you became involved in what you're doing, because making an end run around the media is crucial, because the media is the mainstream is only going to cover what it covers, and it may be incapable of seeing beyond what it's able to see. About a year ago, the Washington Post did an analysis of its own really bad coverage of the buildup to the Iraq War, and and it's misleading reporting in regard to that. And one of the people that it quoted was the great Watergate icon Bob Woodward, who said very apologetically, "I think I was part of the groupthink." In other words, the groupthink at the time was there were weapons of mass destruction, war was necessary and inevitable, and anybody that even started looking at it differently risked career suicide.
And that listening is, to and veteran that journalist Bob Kohler.
And Woodward conceded that he was part of that groupthink as well. There's a tremendous amount of groupthink that congeals, that makes the media the coherent entity that it is, and it's very scary. I work 10 floors above the media, represented by the Chicago Tribune. And so my newsroom, Brad said we were going to compare the size of our newsrooms. My newsroom is the size of the cubicle that I work in. So I'm really am an outsider. Even though I work in the belly of the beast, I am an outsider, and I am totally immune to the groupthink. I'm not part of it, and I don't have to please editors. I just conceive of the stories on my own, and I send them out there, and I try to make them well written enough so that some editors will be attracted to them and have the courage to run them. And that's one way to start throwing darts at the wall. But I think more crucial is what the internet does. The important news has life of its own on the internet, thanks to Brad and thanks to dozens or even hundreds of other really sharp, articulate, tech-savvy bloggers. And I don't know how you do it.
I don't know how I do it.
I don't know how you do it. I mean,
I make stuff up.
Yeah, no. I know you don't make stuff up. How do you keep going? How did you get started? What made you get started? And how,
Now we have Bob Kohler interviewing Brad Friedman.
I'm talking about myself.
I'm not either, but I'm doing it.
Too bad.
Yeah.
You get paid to do it. You have to answer for it, my friend. I started doing this. It was really just I had been producing a show, a stage show, for about 5 years in Los Angeles. Very popular, sold out every week, different show every week, so I was used to doing something all the time. And we finally stopped doing that show, and after a while, I got kind of bored. So I started a blog. My girlfriend Desi, who's sitting over there, it's her fault. Don't you duck down, Desi. She said, hey, why don't you start a blog? I said, what's a blog? She said, oh, it's a weblog, and yada, yada, yada. I look into it, and I said, okay. And so I posted about cartoons, and I think my cat was just about to die and ended up dying, and I wrote about that. And
but you
and that
didn't
was about
die in
it.
Vain.
Well, no. Well, apparently not. Thank you. she didn't. Because apparently after a while, I started noticing stuff out there and talking about what I was noticing. And people were noticing that I was noticing, and they were spreading that around, and folks like Washington Post started noticing what I was noticing. And specifically, I think the first story that caught people's notice was the White House website scrubbing incident.
Right. Okay.
And if you call it scrubbing, and you take a Drudge siren, and you put it at the top, it gets people's attention.
Right.
Sometimes you got to do that to get people's attention. This was a siren-worthy story, as we say. And what happened was, just very briefly, there was the vice presidential debate between Dick Cheney and John Edwards. And John Edwards was talking about the fact that Americans had taken 90% of the casualties in Iraq. And Dick Cheney was indignant and he was insulted because John Edwards was not including the Iraqis as part of the coalition of the willing. And when he said 90%, and how dare you, sir, insult the good folks of Iraq who, by not including their numbers. Well, I thought, well, that was very interesting. I didn't realize Iraq was part of the coalition of the willing.
Yeah, really.
So I went to the White House website, and they had a lot of stuff about the Iraq war and a little link that said lists of members of the coalition of the willing. Oh, perfect. I can see, Iraq right there. Clicked on it. Nothing there.
The whole coalition was gone.
Yes, the whole coalition was gone.
Oh, my God.
Yes, in an eerie foreshadowing for what was to come, apparently.
Right.
So there was nothing there. So I thought it must be a mistake. I wrote to the webmaster. Apparently, you've lost the coalition of the willing. I didn't hear back, and so I reported on this, that it wasn't there, and then people started writing back to me and saying, guess what else isn't there? You know that time when George Bush said he didn't care about that much about Osama bin Laden or whatever the hell that speech was? That video was gone. All sorts of video was gone. All sorts of audio was gone. This was the week before the 2004 election. I told people about it. People noticed. Word got around. Washington Post, in a rare journalistic fit, reported it. I don't know I don't know what they were thinking. And it caused enough noise that in the week prior to the election, that little thing that I noticed and told people about made the White House webmasters, whatever they are, in the week of their election, actually spend hundreds and hundreds of hours restoring thousands and thousands of gigabytes to the White House website.
So you made trouble.
Yeah, I did, apparently, but all I was doing was reporting what I was seeing and telling the truth, and I think that, I use that story sometimes when I talk because it points out that one person makes a difference, and I wasn't trying to have a mercurial career or whatever it was that she said earlier. I don't give a damn about that. I feel like this is, frankly, my duty, and the more that I hear about it, the more that I realize it is, and the more that I realize I have to keep doing this and keep reporting this and keep reporting these things that the media is not reporting, at least until they start doing it again, and then I can retire.
Right.
And I look forward to it. But I have to keep doing it, much, I think, as everyone in this house probably understands exactly what I'm talking about, why you guys are all citizens in the rain tonight who came out and who are still talking about this damn thing 11 months after it happened, and you're not supposed to be talking about this now. This was not supposed to be an issue.
You're supposed to be over it by now.
Exactly. Yeah, you're supposed to have gotten over it, moved on, taken off your tinfoil hats, your conspiracy theories, and guess what? Here we are 11 months later. And we still give a damn, and we're still talking about it, and we're still passing around emails and telling people what we saw, and we need to continue doing it because we're getting better at this. I'm going to talk for a few minutes tomorrow about this phony baloney Baker Carter Commission. Who better to run a National Election Reform Commission than James Baker? He reformed the vote in 2000, didn't he?
Yeah.
He decided that we didn't have to count the votes anymore. We could just go. So, so I'm going to talk about that. Thank you. What? Tell people we're streaming. What? Odie McClay, we're streaming tonight, and we're getting this out. And then this is all going out. Thank you, due to Odie. He's being the media. KPFTX.org is streaming it, right? And tomorrow we're doing the Brad Show from here, too, for 4 hours. So, you just have to be the media. Yeah, I'm doing a radio show now. Okay. If we have to, we will. Any way possible to get the word out. So, what I started to say, though, very quickly, because we have to wrap up here tonight, the Baker-Carter Commission, they came out with their recommendations last Monday, something like that. And by the end of the week, because we were so aware of what was going on and what these guys were doing and what this hoax was, because we reported on what they were going to do before they did it, because we were paying attention, because we know about this phony, baloney, nonpartisan American Center for Voting Rights group. If you don't know about it, go read the Brad blog. But they're a bunch of fake partisans, who are acting like they're nonpartisans, high-level GOP operatives. We're paying attention. I'm writing about it. You guys are passing it around. So by the time the week ended, after this terrific national election reform report that Baker Carter put out, there was James Baker and Jimmy Carter in the New York Times on the defensive, trying to say, please, please, our report, it's really good. And people have misunderstood it, and they've mischaracterized it, and it's complete. And they're on the defensive, okay? Usually,
yeah.
Usually it's us. Usually it's the good guys who are playing the defensive and trying to catch up. And finally, we're making them do it. And that's because all of you people here are making noise. You're doing it every day. You must continue doing it. Bob Kohler, please continue to do it. Don't let those bastards at the Tribune Media push you around. Don Wycliffe, don't let him push you around. Send letters, guys. Support organizations like this. Support the Brad blog. Support the folks out there who are trying to make a difference against all odds, including Bob Kohler, who, frankly, is risking a pretty nice job over there at the Chicago Tribune to tell the truth. So, when you see articles like his, rare as they are, send letters to the editor. Let them know that was a great article. We need you.
Right.
I want to close with words of yours, but okay. I want to let you...
Well, the other side writes, too, and editors are terrified of the other side. And so it's really, I think that's another reason to write in support of progressive writers that do make it into print, because they're going to get a lot of hate mail that the editors react to, and realize, and then they say, well, the readers don't like this kind of stuff, we can't run it. So we've got to write and make our voices heard so that the editors do their job and at least run both, run a variety of viewpoints and not just, pro-Bush.
That's fair and balanced, Bob.
Yeah.
Balance is baloney. All right, let me just close with this. We ran long because I yammered on. I'll stick around. We're out of time for questions, I think, but I will stick around and talk to folks if anybody has anything they want to ask me. Bob, I know you're going to fly out of here into your limo back to Chicago.
Well, I right.
You'll sneak.
No, I'm I'll be around. I'm just I'm here for the whole weekend. I'm here to learn, and so I'll be around.
Thank you. Let me close. Let me close with words from Bob Kohler that these actually were run by the Tribune Media Services in your original column on this, the silent scream of numbers. In contrast to the deathly silence of the media is the silent scream of the numbers. The more you ponder these numbers and all the accompanying data, the louder that scream grows. Did the people's choice get thwarted? Were thousands disenfranchised by chaos in the precincts, spurious challenges, and uncounted provisional ballots? Were millions disenfranchised by electronic voting fraud on insecure, easily hacked computers? And who is authorized to act if this is so? Who is authorized to care? No one, apparently, except average Americans who want to be able to trust the voting process again and who want their country back. Count me amongst them. Thank you, Bob Kohler.
Thank you, Brad.
Thank all you guys. Take your country back. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brad and Bob. Let them hear it. How about our first day of our summit, everyone? Good? Have we established a base camp?
All right.
Yes. Okay, I have two very important things to tell you. One is, tomorrow we're getting started at 8:30, and wear your bow tie. Oregon's congressman from the 3rd District, Earl Blumenauer, will be here to wake you up and get you started tomorrow morning. The other thing I want to tell you, this is like just even more important, our town is famous for micro beer. So, enjoy, but please come back. Thanks a lot, Brad and Bob. You're great.
Thank you, buddy.
The National Summit to Save Our Elections. You're just listening to Brad Friedman and Bob Kohler. Bob Kohler of the Tribune Syndicate and the Chicago Tribune, the world's greatest newspaper. And always has the little flag. You can't hear? Nothing. Can you hear now?
Yeah, okay.
Come on, trade here.
No, that's okay.
These are louder.
Go ahead.
Doing a technical thing, I hope his earphones aren't very loud.
Okay.
But I knew that. And we're coming to you here from live at this moment from Portland, Oregon, the First Unitarian Church. This is the National Summit to Save Our Elections, and it is kind of national. There are people here from all over.
There are. Most of the crowd seems to be relatively local, mostly around Oregon, maybe some Washington folks. But the speakers are definitely from all over. And I think they've done a really nice job of getting speakers with a variety of expertise, you know, lawyers, computer people, journalists, bloggers, and activists, certainly. As Bob Kohler said, the veteran journalist, you know, stay around here and talk for a few hours, you'll learn something.
I'm listening.
Well, yeah.
That's how we learn. I don't know if I said that this is the voice of Pokey Anderson that you're hearing, and I'm Otis McClay.
It's interesting to, you know, if I say when I speak about this that it's a little tricky to judge the level of knowledge and experience of your audience in what's called election reform, transparent, verifiable elections, because there are, you know, there's some people who just probably walked in off the street, you know, first time, and there are other people who've been working away on it, like, so for instance, Ronnie Duggar, who's going to be speaking this weekend, for, 15 years.
He'll be the third Texan.
Right. Kip Humphries is also a Texan.
Right.
He's here.
Holly Jacobson is here and Ellen Tyson. No, hey, listen, we have two listeners. I mean, and they're the right ones. So Holly is bringing, apparently she's come here with a pizza. What? Yeah, sit down. Sit down for a second. Sit down, you can speak. Tell, Holly was speaking this afternoon about the event in New Mexico, and you only had half an hour, I think.
That's right. Do you want me to say something about that now?
Yeah, say a little bit about what's going on in
New Mexico.
Well,
right now, actively, we have a lawsuit that's active. That's the purpose of the lawsuit is to obtain a permanent injunction against the machines that we have proof that caused so many problems in the last election, so we can keep them from being used in future elections. And we're in the discovery phase of the lawsuit, and you can go to www.voteraction.org and tomorrow and learn about discovery. We're posting that tonight.
Very good.
And I'll see you tomorrow. I think I'm going to be talking to Brad tomorrow.
Yep. And Holly's going to be on the Brad blog, the Brad show tomorrow. The Brad show will be coming up at 4 p.m. Pacific. It'll be at its regular time. That would be 7 Eastern. And we will be doing it live from here at the First Unitarian Church here in Portland, Oregon. People are standing around and talking, and apparently we had a I'm trying to think of a good word for this. It's an inviting event. And the thing about these events that's really interesting is not so much that you sit there and be instructed and hear things. Certainly you have a chance to hear what other people are doing. But people start talking to each other, and you know, it's hard to know what is going to come out of that. Clearly, the question in my mind, at least, is why isn't everybody outraged? Why aren't people saying, how dare you steal our election? And that would be people on both sides. I guess we've moved into a situation where people would like to win at all costs, even if it's because the other guy broke his leg. And that's pretty pitiful. It would be nice to be in a country where people genuinely want to find out what the sense of the nation is and then have a government that carries that out. Right now, George Bush is certainly not reflecting the sense of the majority, if the polls mean anything, given that he's well below 50% now in approval rating, and I assume that a lot of that has to do with the conduct of the war in Iraq. Tomorrow, starting at 8:30 here, which is a much more reasonable 11:30 Eastern, Earl Blumenauer, who is the congressman from the 3rd District of Oregon, and I unfortunately don't know enough about Oregon to know where the 3rd District is, but I suspect it's somewhere near Portland. He'll be speaking at first, and then Tom Hartman, who is a national talk show host as well as a local Portland talk show host, will be talking corporate ownership of our elections, the threat to our democracy.
And Tom speaks really well on that. Yeah. He's quite
very sympathetic.
He's almost a Renaissance man. He's written books about all kinds of things,
yeah.
And about Thomas Jefferson. He's got a graphic novel. I don't know. It's not a novel. It's like a cartoon book called We the People,
uh-huh,
that covers all kinds of issues like corporate control, transparent elections, concentration of wealth. It's really wonderful. It's out in the lobby. We the People. You that can't go out in the lobby, you might want to see if one of your bookstores would get you a copy of it. It's wonderful. I bought like 12 copies to give away.
You like it?
It's that good.
You think it's a good book? Yeah, and actually coming from Pokey, that's pretty high praise, given that you did even run a bookstore.
Right. Yeah, I didn't usually buy books to give them away.
Give them away. Then they're going to have a panel discussion with John Gideon, Nancy Price, and Matt Pascarella. John Gideon has been very active.
He was just standing here.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's involved in Voters Unite, and
he's
puts
one of the
together.
Founders.
the archives that is, like I said before, it's incredible. It's www.votersunite.org. You can go in there and you can find lists of computer election mess-ups by vendor. So if you want to see all the things that have been, gone wrong with ES&S or with Diebold or Hardiner Civic or whoever, you can put it in there and get that list. You can find articles about specific places or, you know, chronologically, it's just it's an amazing reference.
So you have Nancy Price. She's from Davis, California, and she's been on the planning commission there and seems to be very interested in sustainable planning. She's worked with the bringing publicly owned green energy to Davis and Yolo County in California, and she's the Western coordinator of the Defending Water for Life program of the Corporate Globalization Positive Alternatives Campaign, and on the leadership team of the Women's International League for Peace and Women, Peace and Freedom's Save the Water campaign. Apparently, a lot of work on water. Of course, water is kind of an issue, since much of it is being purchased by corporations. What's part of the subject that we're discussing here tonight is corporate control.
Corporate control of things that ought to be controlled by the people, the public, the commons, and water. I mean, actually, you could do without oil, but you can't do without water.
Yeah, and water, of course, water in California is always an interesting issue. Giving water to Los Angeles, which is basically a desert, and involves the use of the entire Colorado River.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that famous Jack Nicholson film, Chinatown, about
we're veering from the topic
Earl
here.
Mulholland. But it's about corporate control.
Right, okay.
And that seems to be the kind of the overarching topic here, because we're talking about corporate control of the elections, and that's one of the themes. So it makes us, I guess it makes us, I don't know, what does that make us, dissident? That we don't really want Perrier to own all the water in the world.
I think we're insurgents.
Insurgents.
Yeah.
That's tomorrow. That's the first thing. Other things tomorrow will be, we'll be talking about digital voting systems for dummies with Kip Humphrey and Clint Curtis.
Right. Kip is a Houstonian computer fella. He was the leading edge behind getting together the Houston conference on elections. That was held one day before the Baker-Carter meeting in Houston, and actually got a tiny bit of mainstream media coverage there, a tiny bit.
Clint Curtis, we've heard from today.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what else is tomorrow. David Cobb is going to give a keynote. Lessons learned from the 2004 presidential election and the Ohio recount. I guess we must have learned some lessons from that so far. But we're going to leave you hanging until tomorrow to find out what they are.
What those lessons might be. Your homework is to read the 100-page document that John Conyers put out on the on Ohio. Actually, you can find a shorter version of that if you don't want to stay up too late. John Conyers has his own blog. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah.
Where? Look up Conyers' blog on Google or one of the
It might be like johnconyers.com or something. It's not under gov. He is he's the kind of congressperson, in my opinion, that if we had another 400 or so, we might get somewhere. He's been leading the charge on all kinds of things.
Steadfast.
Amazing guy.
The Carter Baker Commission, Voter ID, and How Ordinary Citizens Can Make a Difference. And Brad Friedman is going to be presenting that. And Joanne Bowman will then be speaking on voter-owned elections. What a concept. Joanne Bowman is was a KABU programmer and a state representative here in Oregon. And she's quite well-known here in Portland. And that should be
a lot of fun. And then at 4, we're going to do the Brad Show. That would be 7 Eastern, 4 here.
Mm-hmm. Now, how are
we'll
you going to do
people
that?
On the Brad Show.
We're not going to be able to stream,
but we'll be continuing to record.
Uh-huh.
So that means we miss a couple of things on the stream, Jefferson Smith, and we've heard Paul Leto. And the musical entertainment apparently will be missing some of that.
Hmm. Well, it'll be fun. And Holly Jacobson is confirmed for the Brad Show.
Right.
So those of you who missed Holly's presentation this afternoon about what's going on in New Mexico and some of those depositions, which I hope that he will grill her on, the depositions by insiders saying, gee, gosh, we're not convinced that these voting systems actually count all the votes. That could be real good. And
I like the idea of going into the back room and coming out with the results. That's my favorite part.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you can't find the results on the machine? Here, give me that. I'll be back in a second.
Right.
Here they are.
Right, here they are.
Yeah.
And also, Otis, you just told me that today's proceedings will be archived ASAP.
The question is, will I have a sufficiently fast upload? And I might try to do it here. The problem is I'm not sure how easy it is to break it down, but I'm going to try to get them up tonight on the KPFTX page, which is probably where you got the link. But they will be there, if not immediately, they will be there quite soon. I think that's what we got.
All right.
That's pretty much what we got. Hokey Anderson. Thank you for being here.
Otis McClay, thank you for dragging all this stuff here and getting it set up.
Yeah, and I had to fly.
Yeah.
But isn't it amazing how little it takes to do this?
Yeah.
This is not rocket science, folks. We need more of this. So anyway, from Portland, Oregon, from the First Unitarian Church, here at the National Summit to Save Our Elections, Otis McClay and Pokey Anderson saying, see you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow. All right.